From the Agile Revolution.
Oh, what the hell, Tony? What's going on? Welcome to the Agile Revolution podcast. Oh, your voice is broken, dude.
Man, I'm sick, so I'm going to fly the coop.
Yeah, get out of here.
So, hi. Typhoid Tony, goodbye.
It's hi and bye from Typhoid Tony. I'll be back next week.
Oh, dear. Welcome to the Agile Revolution podcast. That was Tony. I'm Craig.
And Renee is here.
I think we've found our name for our podcast, Typhoid Tony.
Typhoid Tony.
Yes. So how are you, Renee?
I'm doing really good. I'm almost over my cold.
Almost.
Almost. It's been going ever since I got back from Austria.
It has been. That was about 14 episodes ago that I think you talked about
your cold. Like 14 episodes ago.
Oh, dear. What's happening in the world of Agile in your space, Renee?
So normally Tony does a lot more of the humorous content than I do, but I've got almost all humorous content. If you're not aware, there is a project going on sponsyoume.com called Agile in a Can.
Yes, I've seen this.
Where you can put some money in towards it. Currently it's at $0 of $20,000.
Yeah, it's one of those jump starter things, isn't it? Like, where you put people pledge the money, and if you get enough money, then it gets over the line. So these guys have got a startup called Agile in a Can.
Correct. So Jim Benson created it, otherwise known as our founder. There's a video on SponsorMe. I actually can't get the video to work, but that could have been my Wi-Fi.
I can get the video to work either, but I read the
blurb. So in essence, it's you can spray your Agile in a Can on your team, and they'll magically be newly agilized, and it'll magically fix your boards too. And if you've got a new customer, you just give them the can. And
where do I sign up for one of these cans, Renee?
Well, you sign up on SponsorMe.com. You've got to make sure that they get their $20,000.
Oh, right, that's right, because they've only got like their one prototype at the moment.
Yes,
the
photos, yes. One prototype.
Yeah. Yes, so you might want to tell your bosses that they can get this Agile in a Can now.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's competing with Agile Silver Bullet.
Yes.
But there's probably a market space for two of those sorts of products out there.
I'm sure there is. I always keep a bottle of Agile in a Can in my coaching kit, just in case.
So you've got the one prototype.
No, I've got my own sort of secret
formula. Secret Craig Agile Revolution formula.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
When do I get my copy of this secret
formula? I sprayed you years ago, Renee.
Not quite sure where this podcast is going. What about you, Craig?
All right. One of the things we quite often, we talk a lot about software development and related type things, but I came across this article, which is publishing ready for Agile, and there's been a lot of I've seen lots of posts in the last one, but I like this one because it just kind of got to the heart of what these guys are thinking. So this is from Publishers Weekly, so completely non-technical.
Oh, really?
Technical.
So a lot of the ones that I've seen have actually come out of the Agile community. So
that's right, and this is what I like this one. So this one is Publishing Ready for Agile by Gabe Habish, and it kind of starts off, Agile is becoming more of a buzzword in publishing circles as companies look to harness the new possibilities digital is providing. But many are unsure whether the Agile model is right, and others still aren't exactly sure what Agile means for publishing. So this is actually around a podcast that they did, but they defined what Agile publishing is, and essentially, and this sounds rather familiar, it's grounded in the customer, getting a lot of good feedback, and not necessarily assuming you know the answer without communication. Sound familiar?
Okay.
So this person who's talking about it laid out the concepts, things like quick cycles, quick as a week.
Yep.
Which the way it's written in there kind of almost sounds like, wow, we could do this in a week.
Yeah.
Self-organizing working groups as opposed to institutional hierarchy, and iterations. And publishers have to assume there's going to be changes along the way. And they go on to say one of the radical differences is that it emphasises process over perfection, which I think is a big deal for the publishing industry because they're in this whole mindset traditionally that
you have to get the book 100% right.
But with digital now, it's a lot easier probably too.
So they're basically inferring publishing as it has moved to the digital space.
Yeah, so what they're going to say here is that the focus on process is difficult for publishers to accept. We don't like typos. We don't like half-finished books. which if you think about it, is exactly what Agile tries to get rid of, because typos are quality. So if you build quality in and you continue to always have something that could be a finished book, then yeah. So I think it's a big change for those guys. In the article, they talk about what, you know, some of the case studies of publishers already using it. So they talk about O'Reilly, who have been doing kind of this stuff, for quite a bit. They have their digital editions come out first. They have lots of table of contents and a few chapters. Manning does the same type of thing.
I believe Lonely Planet is investing in that area right now.
Yeah, Wattpad is another one, which is a very crowdsourced content platform. And Harvard Business Review, because it actually goes directly to customers as well. So there's an interesting little article that I just came across there, but it's nice to see, I guess, that the same types of ideas are being taken by someone. And if anyone needs to get on board, you know, publishing industry is probably one of those ones that if they can kind of adapt to some of these changes, then they will survive through the digital turnover.
Mm. There's also a recent video release by Adam Weisbart. I don't know whether you've seen it at all. It's SH*T Scrum Masters Say.
Yes, yes.
So
it's been out for a little while.
It's been out for about at least a couple of months. Mm. So if you have a spare couple of minutes, I would recommend having a look at that video. It's just a funny parody.
So SHOT Scrum Masters Say?
Yeah, something like SHOT Scrum Masters Say.
Yeah, okay.
PG-related podcast, so we can't say the word. Nor does it actually say the word. It's got an asterisk in there as well.
So it's like that shot my dad says television show.
Yes, yeah. Yes. But in essence, it's just a parody of the sorts of really bad things that some Scrum Masters can come out with.
Any examples there, Renee?
Not off the top of my head.
It's been about a few months since I've read it.
I know I sent a couple through to Adam, so I didn't actually double check if some of them ended up in the video.
So did you remember what any of those are?
Sorry?
Do you remember what any of those are you sent?
No, that was like over half a year ago.
So why are you bringing this up now?
Because I think it's a really funny video.
Oh, that's right, you're on your funny edition of the Agile Revolution.
Damn it, yes.
All right, well, I'll ground us again, sorry. This one was a recent article by Jez Humble. You might remember him, wrote the Continuous Delivery book, and has been kind of touring the planet with ThoughtWorks, you know, kind of pushing that type of thing. And he's just written a recent article called Why Software Development Methodologies Suck. And this was on D-Zone. And he goes on, you know, saying that there's a lot of dogma and, you know, religious wars. And his argument is that while scientific evidence says that things like, you know, does TDD make for high-quality software, is pair programming a superior placement for code review, there are two general principles that can help us choose good practices: reducing cycle time and increasing feedback. Which, like, yeah, I think it's pretty, pretty straightforward, and is at the heart of the Agile Manifesto and things like that.
Well, actually, I agree with reducing cycle time and increasing feedback. For me, those are the very essence, but it's not actually written anywhere.
Yeah, it's implied though. I mean, you know, by short, you know, short small iterations and batch sizes, which, you know, I forget the wording that's in those principles now in the manifesto. They're not in the four statements of the manifesto, but they're in the principles. And feedback is certainly in there as well, in the principles. So I think it was always implied it's there. It doesn't mention cycle time.
No, but I just think that it's interesting that's something that we believe, but I don't know whether people who are just starting Agile would necessarily get that.
No, I agree, but most people don't go and read the 12 principles of the manifesto either and subscribe to them, or you get that scrum butt type thing that happens where people go, oh yeah, we'll do stand-ups, we won't do retrospectives, we'll do TDD, we won't do pair programming.
But scrum still says 4 weeks or 1 month for iterations.
Not the latest version, remember?
The latest version says could be smaller, but it's still giving that 4 week mark.
True. Alright, moving on. The point of the article is that he's essentially saying, you know, that software development methodologies suck, exactly for that reason, I guess. And what I like is he's got this diatribe in here. So the first thing he talks about is like skilled developers, which on an upcoming podcast, I go on a complete hour-long rant about why developers aren't skilled and probably aren't as good as they should be. So listen out for that one. That was the mashup podcast that we recently did with the Legal Arguments. So watch out for that on the channel coming soon. But I think the thing about this particular article is that he goes in like he references a book by Laurent Boisvert called The Leprechauns of Software Engineering, and in that particular book he goes on an attack, essentially the whole book on attack of software development folklore, such as the cost of change, and that all those theories depend on very small sets of data, so we can't back them up. And I guess he's going through all these particular things that are in the software development methodologies, and you know, the fact of the matter is that at the end of the day, do they really make any world of difference? So he comes back and says that the clincher is, it's virtually impossible for us to practice continuous improvement, to learn how to get better as teams or individuals, and to acquire the skills that enable the successful creation of great products and services, unless we focus on getting the feedback loop as short as possible so we can actually detect correlations and discern cause and effect. Mm-hmm. So people just blindly go and follow these methodologies, whatever you want, doesn't actually result in anything being any better. And this is where I have a problem with this article, because I agree with everything he says, that all the things like doing a daily stand-up, right, standing in front of a board for 15 minutes doesn't make an iota of difference, but it's something that helps, all these practices help
create
the team together.
The feedback loop itself,
that's
right?
Exactly right.
So some methodologies are better than others at creating feedback loops.
Yeah, and essentially that's what he's really trying to say here is that... his last comment here is that software development methodologies, even the hire a bunch of awesome people and let them self-organize model, suck because they so often lead to cargo cult behavior, which is exactly right. Like, almost every agile implementation I've read about or seen happen has always started with some passionate person that's gone, here's a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is that the rest of the people, not your A people, but your B's and C's, come along for the ride and then just follow through blindly the process without understanding why they do it, which then leads to this whole degradation of the process in the first place. And so this is his argument, is that we get this cargo cult behaviour because people forget about having organisations that learn and adapt as fast as possible. And, I've seen a lot of people talking about this at the same time. The interesting thing about this article, and it's on D-Zone, so, a whole bunch of developers, is that he's essentially saying, look, these methodologies are really good, it's just that they kind of suck and you need to do better at them. What's far more interesting in the article is you go read the comments and then you get all the people going, oh, yeah, we know that Agile sucks, we know that Scrum is not that great. But these are probably the same people that are causing the problem in the first place, and I think that's... it's not for the people that are listening to podcasts like this. I think most people kind of get it. They're either trying to find their way or they're already along for the journey. But this is kind of one of those articles that stood out. It's got that title,
It's for those people that just want to be told the way.
Well, I think it's almost...
and not think about it.
I think it's one of these articles that I can see being retweeted and everything around the planet where people go, oh, yeah, so just humbleness is that Agile's no good. It's exactly not what he's saying at all. But people want to read what they want to hear. So
okay.
As soon as you see this kind of thing, oh, well, yeah, he said they suck, so we don't go and do them. But what do you replace it with? And what he's saying is that, we actually have to go and get better as a community. What this is really saying is that we've still got a long way to go in refining our practices and getting better and finding things that actually make those things work. And that's really the heart of what most Agile teams do anyway.
So it's an evolutionary change process?
Yeah. Exactly, which was written into the process all those years ago. So anyway, it's an interesting article. Go have a look at it. But he talks a lot about lean thinking and cycle time, as I said, and feedback loops. And if you think about it, that's the heart of what continuous deployment is. If you're really going to follow around continuous deployment, you need all those things to make that work.
Yeah. So, if you're also interested, when I presented at last conference, a week and a bit ago, I did a gamification and agile one, and one of the key elements that I talked about in that presentation was feedback loops and the importance of making them as tight and as fast as possible, and sort of compared it with waterfall as well.
Awesome. Anything else from you?
So I just want to... I'm going to have trouble actually sending a link because I can't find a link now. So there was a post...
So did you just make this up in your mind?
No, I didn't make it up in my mind. There was a post on agilemanagement.net last month, somewhere around about the 17th and 18th of July. And it was talking about some changes that were made within David J. Anderson's sort of area and how a number of his associates have finished up work. and how he was going to potentially look at revamping up later in the year. So I can't really find the post anymore. I think it might have been pulled. Not quite sure why, whether it was for legal reasons.
Are you sleuthing, Renee?
Am I what?
Are you being sleuthing?
No, I haven't been sleuthing. So I think it's been pulled. But I think, you know, when I saw the article, I actually sent some tweets to David Jansen to actually confirm a couple of concerns that I had around that. So specifically, if people remember from the Lean Kanban University podcast, we talked about the fact that when you do accredited training, or training with accredited trainers, my apologies, that you receive 1 year access to the special section in the Lean Kanban University site. Do you remember that?
The sealed section, yes.
Yeah, the sealed section, of which the sealed section isn't there today. And my concern was, well, these people, and I thought at least one of them was involved in creation of that session, section. So my concern was, is that still going ahead or not? So for those people who have been on the accredited training for Kanban through Lean Kanban University and have that year membership, they are still intending to publish that restricted section around and pick it up at around about November this year, so it's still coming.
A work in progress,
yeah.
I mean, Dad Jance has been very busy, right? I notice his book has finally made it to the shelves this week.
Yep. And in essence, he said that the reason why they did that was they wanted to reduce the burn rate, ramping up at the end of the year. Basically, it reflects the current economy and there's a lack of demand for training over the summer months in the Northern Hemisphere.
Cool. Last one from me. This report came out quite a while ago, and I only just sort of picked it up because it was a blog post that was kind of referring back to it, but the PMI, my good friends of the PMI, have released earlier in the year their report, which is the Pulse of the Profession report.
Really?
Right.
So wait, really? The PMI have a pulse?
Apparently. It's called the Pulse of the Profession.
And it's not just project managers' pulse?
That I can't guarantee. Driving success in challenging times is the headlight. The thing that I kind of piqued my interest is that even the PMI made you know reference to agile, essentially straight in their report.
Which you'd expect because they've got accreditation now.
Yeah, although even though they've got accreditation, I think they still. I know. I think there's amongst their members, there's still this kind of like, oh yeah, it'll go away, type mentality. It's there, but you know, I think there's
an ostrich in the sand mentality, right?
Yeah, that's a really good analogy. There you go. So one other thing, I guess it's the second dot point they've got is that organisations are going to continue to strive for agility in order to leverage ever-shifting market conditions. Change management and project risk management will become even more important core competencies, and it said that the survey shows that 70% of respondents always or often use change management and risk management, and also says that there's a large percentage of their readers that actually already use Agile. And I'll get that number as I scroll through here. But it was actually, to me, it was nowhere near the number that we typically see in things like the chaos reports, but it was still, you know, kind of like a reasonably large number. And of course, I can't find as I'm scrolling through this report now.
But this is numbers of what do they survey?
So they've been surveying, I guess, organisations, and I suspect, although I didn't actually read this in here, annual global survey of practitioners and project management leaders. It contains feedback from over 1,000 professionals across a variety of experience levels and industries, although you'd have to think that is probably the membership of the PMI.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, although it doesn't say that. So there's a couple of interesting things in there, and I'll find the Agile number in a moment. But if you remember the Standish Chaos Report, these guys actually reckon that 64% of projects successfully met their original goals and business intent in 2011 based on what they found in the survey.
Was better than previous years.
Yeah, which means that over one-third did not. And then they say, what differentiates those organisations with high success rates? And, of course, it's the PMI, right? If you follow their processes, then you're actually in a much better place.
What?
So they've got this thing, and I'm showing Renee this, but if you look in the report, which we'll put in the show notes, but they've got this graph about organisational maturity level. And obviously, if you've got a low maturity level, then your percentage of getting things on time and on budget is around about 30-40%. But if you've got a high maturity, then it's more around the 60-70% type number. My problem is that it's still 70%. Yeah, not reaching for the stars, guys. Like, there's still a fair way off. And, even 40-60%, is actually not a lot of variance. So at the end of the day, it's kind of like, well, maybe we don't have any project managers at all and just cross our fingers and hope for the best.
Yeah, I mean, I sent out several Twitter requests a little while ago asking for people if they can find or point me to some PMI-related statistic that basically says if you're PMI certified, you've got a higher chance of success.
And?
No data came back.
Still waiting for the responses.
Still waiting for data. So maybe, in reality, I should ask PMI that question and actually get some data back.
Well, they're busy. I found the number, right? The survey found that more than, 25% of respondents now use agile project techniques frequently, and the number is likely to keep moving up.
Well, that's not bad. Keeping in mind that they're project managers, and it's for a community that has traditionally been a bit slow in the uptake.
Okay, well, all I'm saying is that these people, right, are our project managers.
Yeah.
And of them, only 25% of their projects
are. But I don't know what you're worrying about, because Scrum doesn't have project managers.
True. And I guess that's maybe my point, is that for all the other numbers that we've got, why are the numbers so vastly different to the PMI to what other numbers have? And is it because the people are going, yeah, we don't need those guys, or we can just pull any person off the street to manage our project? Scrum Master's enough. So I can't really pull too much more correlation of it, but it's worth having just a quick flip through. It's not a massive report. It's only about 6 or 7 pages, but there's some really interesting things from their point of view in the report.
Okay, and if anyone's listening and they actually know the figures of being PMI certified and actually making a difference, let me know. Though I'm curious about whether the same could be said for all the certifications that are out there.
True.
Okay, it could just as equally apply to, say, Scrum Masters. If you're Scrum Master certified versus not, does that necessarily mean you're any better? I suspect probably not.
And look, in order to close this off, because now I pretty much alienated every person in the industry, so for my friends, project managers, the one thing I will say is that I am glad to see that at least someone like the PMI has stepped up and is at least trying to train people. And people have their own views on certification. I think certification is good. What I don't like is, for example, I know someone that's just recently done Prince 2, right? They go on a 5-day course, right? They cram five days of content into 3 days and then spend an entire day telling them how to pass the exam, and they sit the exam. That, to me, is not right. Right, certification...
That's gaming the system.
Yeah, certification's original intent is go and learn the stuff and then sit the exam and prove that you actually learned something. And that's why certification gets a bad rap. So, if you actually sat there and you really understood what the PMI, there's lots of really good work gone into the project management body of knowledge that is in the PMI. They spent a lot of effort and time. And
yeah, they did. They did a lot of really big community work.
And there's a lot of respected people from the Agile community that were in on it. So, I don't have any problem with that. The thing with these surveys is that it's not those people that get surveyed, it's just the typical project manager. And I think the thing that stood out to me is just that, that we've still got a long way to go with that project management community, but at least it's a start.
So I want to sort of backtrack a little bit to one of the posts that you said, but also backtrack to a previous podcast where we were talking about capabilities.
We're going back in time.
Capabilities and methodology. So I made the comment that, for a while, I'm quite cognizant that as an agile process that we own at the moment, it's sort of grown to be bigger than Ben-Hur. It's definitely deviated away from what it was many, many years ago, it being a very simple process. It's now looking more like a methodology, and a lot of the training that we have is focused, or looking to be focused, at a role layer. And the question that I had with you is around, well, is this right? Should we, when we're training BAs, for example, be training them not just agile skills, but also general BA competency skills? Same goes for devs, same goes for testers.
You know the answer why to this is, and it's my favourite answer, when we train together, Renee?
It depends.
Yeah. I think in average is basically, and I'm interested in your views on this, but my point of view, firstly, is that we are here to teach people to think differently and to think for themselves, and you know, and to deliver, you know, quality projects. That's what we're here to do. Unfortunately, particularly in large enterprises and organisations, the skill sets that people have, either when we hired them or degradation, means that a lot of people that I come across, business analysts, testers, developers, project managers, all of them,
regardless of agile, don't have it.
Yeah. Right? I find so many business analysts that couldn't critically think if it, you know, if it had to save their life. I find testers that all they can do is click buttons on a screen. I see software developers that have never picked up a book or thought outside the square, or you know, thought, well, maybe I could do some automated testing, or what would happen if I, you know, actually went and fixed some of those 4,387 lines of code that are showing up in Sonar. Right? Project managers that, you know, wouldn't know how to run a bath, let alone a project. Like, you come across those all the time, and unfortunately when you're a coach and you're trying to extract delivery, it does push you into the position of actually having to essentially coach those people through that. But with the same added, you know, it depends on there, is that, you know, I'm not going to go and try and teach a project manager how to be good, become a good project manager, because I wouldn't consider myself to be a good project manager. I can only, you know, send them in the direction. But I find in large organisations, particularly, I just had this discussion with someone at a in a recent training course, where they went, oh, I don't need to improve my skills because the company doesn't, you know, doesn't invest in me, so why would I bother, right? I've got a life outside of what I do here.
Mm.
And my argument to them was that for yourself, right, you know, to be an you know, to be an IT professional, you know, what have you read or watched or seen or sat in on at least in the last year, right?
Yeah.
I didn't realise people have, you know, people aren't like us who sit around and do podcasts and you know, read this stuff all day every day, and you know we communicate at, you know, odd hours of the night, right, about things that we found and read. That's the way we're wired, right? And I don't expect everyone to be like that. But I do expect that anyone I hire into a technical team as an IT professional, and they're all those roles, I do expect them to have some level of, you know, onward training and commitment into their own craft.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is I just don't see enough of that, particularly in large organisations, particularly the ones that we normally come along to help.
So why do you think that's the case?
I think at the end of the day, I mean, you know, there's lots of different reasons why people have got themselves into technology teams, and for a lot of people it's just a nice little, you know, cozy chasm where you can kind of sit and huddle up, and you know, if you know a system reasonably well because you've worked on it for the last 20 years, you know, why do you need to go and improve your craft any?
So you think it's that then they're not in an environment where they have to learn?
I think so, and I also think that a lot of our leadership lets us down, because you know, they're not really looking for skill sets, they're just looking for whether the job is getting done. And sometimes that gets, one gets masked by the other. Right, the job might get done, but no one's asking the question, could we have done it, you know, 10 times more efficiently?
Mm.
Yeah, because I've seen, you know, business analyst testers, if I use, you know, those two as an example. Yeah, I mean, you know, anybody can usually get through some analysis if you really try, right, if you read enough and you know, all the rest of it. And yes, you know, business analysts, if they've been doing this for a while, they can get through that. But, you know, I've seen some of them, they go and do investigations, take 2, 3, 4 weeks. And Liz go, oh, we got through it. But I look at it and go, I reckon we probably could have knocked that over in 3 days. Same with testing.
Mm.
You know, it's, you know, we could do automation, so I have to repeatedly do stuff. But it's just looked at the fact to go, oh, well, we went in, there was no defects, and you obviously produced this big pile of documentation. Everything must have been good. So going back to your original question, I think when you're actually coaching or scrum master, you know, on the spot, I don't think you have any choice but not to help people improve their skill set. If you're talking about just training in general, as an agile community, yeah, I don't think our job is to go and make people better project managers. That's why the PMI exists. That's why you know, the business IOBA, and the Babok exist. It's why in the development community there's lots of, you know, all the different languages have their own different communities, and the, you know, same goes for testers. They have their own certifications. There is a craft that you have to bring to the table. Unfortunately, sometimes I think we have to push people in the direction.
Okay, so I mean,
what do you think?
I think that people should take responsibility for their own learning. Definitely.
Do you see evidence of that?
No, I think some people do, some people don't. And I don't know the answers as to why some people do and some people don't. I would have educated guesses, but at the end of the day, they're all guesses. I think that a lot of people are just here for their jobs and...
Punching the clock.
And in essence, something has happened at their environment that has caused them to lose the passion.
So is that leaders letting them down in some cases?
No, I don't think it's necessarily leaders. It could be the team environment that they're in as well.
But regardless of that, though, you know, when was the last time you honestly sat at a performance review or and I've spoken to people about this as well, so just not just you know, my leaders, but people I've spoken to, and I've asked the question. I mean, I do lots of assessment statistics, for example. I ask the question, does your leader actually ask you about your craft? Like, what have you done to improve your craft? I mean, a lot of performance reviews have that kind of thing, you know, on there, like, have you done any learning?
Yeah,
right.
What was your development plan?
Yeah, and I can normally go, oh, I went to a training course once.
Yeah. Right?
You know, it could have been in how to use a fire extinguisher for all, you know.
True, for all
that someone cares, right? But I think the problem is that a lot of times our leaders don't actually take an active interest to say, do the people I have, the people I'm paying lots and lots of money for, because they are our most expensive, you know, resource, you know, are we actually keeping them maintained in the same way that we think about our software, in the same way we think about, you know, the microwave in the kitchen? Because I think we spend a lot more time worrying about that, right? If the microwave in the kitchen is not cooking your lunch, right, someone's going to be going there and fixing it, right?
Yep.
So why aren't we actually taking more attention to go, hang on, is that BA really giving us good business analysis, or is that project manager really giving us good project management? And I think we can throw courses at people, like, oh, we'll send them an Agile course, that'll fix it, but...
Yeah, I don't think that will fix it, because I think for me it comes down to passion. I think the people that I see that aren't learning don't have the passion.
Yeah, but I think on the same token, lots of companies are very good at throwing those learning opportunities at people, but how often do you hear, like, time being the, you know, I didn't have time, we did this through the deadlines, you know, all that kind of thing. Yeah, look, we all have time issues.
Okay, yes. So it's a two-edged sword. You need to be able to have an environment where you've got the passion, but you also need the organisational maturity to create a learning environment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think what the problem is that we check the people who've done training. What we don't check is they've actually taken something away from that training or from that learning.
Well, learning doesn't have to be just training either. I want to put that out there. I mean, there's more
true.
There.
So I'm just using that as an example, because yep. Managers are usually pretty good at shoving somebody on a training course.
Yeah.
Right. That's the easiest way of, you know, of getting learning up and running. But yeah, if someone's a professional, I would actually, you know, like to have seen that they've done one thing in the last year, right? Read one book.
Yeah.
Right? If I pick those four roles, right, every one of those roles has had a good book released in the last, you know, 12 months. A really good book that's worth reading, whether it's Agile related or whether it's, you know, just in the field related. There'll be something out there that's of relevance, right? And if it's not that, it might be something like a systems thinking or something like that as well, that you know, that maybe that would help them, or reading a book like Tribes or Drive or something, right? There'll be something, just some non-fiction thing. And people don't like to read, because we go, oh, I don't read very
well. There's plenty of videos, then, you're listening to podcasts.
Yeah. So, again, it's not the people that are listening to this the issue, but...
But the people listening to this have to inspire the others.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I just want to put it out there. I mean, there are models for different types of learning. There's the 70-20-10 model, which is basically, you know, 70% of what you learn is on the job, 20% is through some sort of community social networking. So, for example... You know, community forums such as LinkedIn groups, dev groups, meetups, relationships inside your team, relationships outside of your team. So people-to-people based learning. And then there's the training, which is the 10%. So a lot of people, when they think about learning, they think about that 10% solely. That it's important to consider the other 90% and learning on a day-to-day basis, and actually recognizing that it is something that you should be doing every single day.
Exactly. Yes.
Is it part of Agile? I don't think so. I don't think it's our responsibility to teach people how to be good BAs, but I do think it's our responsibility to teach them, using Agile, the techniques that they can use to be better.
As a community, I completely agree with you. As people that are inside teams trying to get them to work better,
yes,
then our responsibility is to try and push them in the right direction, or try and build that capability. And part of it, when we get asked to do Agile transformations, is that we can't help but not essentially have to go back and say to people, well, if you don't uplift the capability in your development space, then we're not going to be ultimately successful. And that's where a lot of them fail, is that people expect to do the same job that they did right yesterday, not make any change, right, but stand in a circle for 15 minutes every day and there'll be a difference.
Yeah, it'd be magic, yeah. Okay.
Because you're still using 15-year-old approaches to things.
So any quotes?
A couple. So Neil Killick on Twitter. One of the first things an agile coach should be explaining to management, we'll be not tracking things in a tool, we'll be busy, too busy doing stuff.
Yep.
That's you.
No.
All right, my second one's Kent Beck. Could we all just agree that the word code freeze is a lousy metaphor and move on? Maybe call it the increasingly terrified of change phase.
Meh.
No, I like that one because, you know, code freeze is a very waterfallish term.
Really? I don't think it is.
If you're moving towards continuous delivery, if you're iterating in cycles, then okay, the word, for me, code freeze, used to be when on teams where I did two-week iterations, code freeze was lunchtime Friday to deploy on, Friday afternoon.
Oh, so for me, code freeze has always been, it's about to be Christmas, we should probably have a stable production environment across all of our systems so that we don't interrupt customer service.
No, that's a deployment freeze. Yeah, so I agree with those, right? Not making changes in areas of time where you might be increased load, like Amazon doesn't make many changes to their system when it's around Black Friday time and the like. If you're in the Easter business, then you're probably not going to make changes to your system right around Easter Bunny time. So, but code freeze is one of those things that particularly when people come to a release, and I've seen that in teams I work with even recently, where they go, okay, we're 2 weeks out, we're going to freeze the code. And then we've got to wait and do some more testing and those
types of things. In that line, I agree. Yep.
So if I read that again, right, we all disagree the code freeze is a lousy metaphor and move on, maybe call it the increasingly terrified of change phase.
Fear of change phase.
Yeah. So if you're freezing, it's essentially going, we're scared about what's going to happen, which means that you probably need some work to do. And I think it goes back to that old analogy that, if you're scared to death of doing it, it's a smell that you need to go and actually fix.
Excellent. So our next podcast will be a little while away.
We've got some in the can, obviously.
We've got some in the can, so I'm not quite sure when this is going to come out in relationship to all the others. I will be probably after this, I'll send out the gamification one, so the presentation that I did at last.
Yeah, so this will be the next podcast on the channel, but you've got the last one, and you've also got...
I've also got a Sensational Sydney, which I think might be coming out very soon, so that'll come out before this.
Yep, and I've also got the mashup we did between the other podcast, Legal Argument and Coding by Numbers.
And then
hopefully we'll have a bit of information coming from Dallas. I'm off to Dallas to Agile 2012.
Wait, you're going overseas?
You guys had a world tour. Tony went to Melbourne.
That's not world tour, by the way.
And you went to Australia without the AL, Austria. So I had to be on the act. So yeah, I'm off, pack my Stetsons and my cowboy hat and off to Dallas.
What's a Stetson?
It's a shoe.
Okay. So you're off for 3 weeks?
Yes, a little bit of holiday at the end. Which
is nice. And are you going to an IC Agile workshop, or are you just attending a meeting there? Is that right?
A couple of things. Hopefully the AAFTT, which is the Functional Testing Tools Workshop, the day before Agile 2012, although we have to see some final details on that, so hopefully that's still going ahead. Agile 2012, which runs all of next week.
But you're not presenting there for a change?
No, they're doing some stuff for InfoQ and wandering the halls and trying to suck up some...
So that'll be nice to not present for a change, right?
It's very nice, at this point, not running around thinking about, is my presentation ready?
Mm-hmm.
And then there's an IC Agile sort of catch up from a bunch of people who are doing some work there. So interesting kind of to see what's happening in that space. I don't really know what to expect out of that. So it's nice to kind of be invited along for that and see what
comes. So we might be able to talk about that when you come back, hopefully.
Maybe.
Hopefully.
Mm.
So thank you once again. You can contact us on podcast.
Oh, one last thing, sorry. One last thing. I just meant to mention that, and I was talking about this, and you were saying the same thing at last. Right, a bunch of people sort of come up to me lately and, hey, are you Craig from the Agile Revolution? Which is actually really cool. So all of my three listeners, thank you. but I had to give a shout out. One person pulled me up at a recent Yao night.
Yes.
And that was Phil. I forget what your last name is, Phil. But he said, are you Craig from the Agile Revolution? I went, yes. And he went, Enjoy listening to the podcast, but I really need to tell you that TFS, right, which is the Team Foundation Server, works really well with Agile. And I don't remember slamming TFS, but you know, I'm pretty sure between all of us, we did, you know, some pretty good damage on that at some point. I'm aware that TFS works with Agile. I think I actually do remember mentioning at some point that it was kind of like a spin-off from the old Greenhopper. There's, you know, also tools like Urban something, the Greenhopper guys anyway, before they got bought by Atlassian and have a spin-off in TFS. But TFS itself, Microsoft have really evolved that in its Agile tooling. So yes, I'm aware that the TFS has Agile stuff built in. So my apologies for all the TFS people that I might have offended at some point. I don't remember doing it.
And if I did, then I'm sorry too.
Yeah.
But
yeah. And for everyone else I offended, I'm sorry about that too. I might as well just get that out there. It seems that every podcast we did that.
So thank you for listening. If you want to contact us, email us at podcast@theagilerevolution or myself at renee@theagilerevolution.com
or Craig at theagilerevolution.com.
Viva la revolution.
Viva la revolution. Until next time.